Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Borderlines, a podcast that is mostly about Canadian immigration law. I'm Stephen Mierens. My guest today is Connie Campbell, a lawyer at Edelman & Co. Section 37A of Canada's Immigration and Refugee Protection Act provides that, quote, a permanent resident or a foreign national is inadmissible on grounds of organized criminality for being a member of an organization that is believed on reasonable grounds to be or to have been engaged in activity that is part of a pattern of criminal activity planned and organized by a number of persons acting in concert in furtherance of the commission of an offense punishable under an act of parliament by way of indictment, or in furtherance of the commission of an offense outside Canada, that if committed in Canada would constitute such an offense, or engaging in activity that is part of such a pattern. So that's a mouthful. It basically provides that a permanent resident or a foreign national is inadmissible to Canada for organized crime. Connie and I break it down in this episode. We also answer a question that was posed to me on social media. In a previous podcast, I said that Deanna and I would discuss whether Canada should screen for anti-Semitism in its immigrants. When I posted on social media, someone responded by essentially saying, well, how about law societies screen lawyers for Islamophobia or anti-Palestinian sentiment? Connie and I discussed this. If you like the podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you listen. The most recent review said, quote, I love the content, but miss having speakers introduced at the start of the discussion. So here I am, back with an intro. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Okay, I am joined today by A. Connie Campbell, who has been on the podcast a couple times, actually, once to do a overview of Section 15 of the Charter and Canadian immigration, as well as on the discussion that we did last year about the Supreme Court of Canada decision in Mason, which involved the Supreme Court reasonably narrowing, in my opinion, the interpretation of what constitutes acts of violence for the purpose of inadmissibility to Canada for security concerns. And during that episode, we touched on how another area of Canadian immigration law that the Supreme Court may need to clarify is inadmissibility to Canada for organized crime. And this is the follow-up episode to that brief discussion that we had there. Connie, thanks for coming back on.
It's a pleasure to be back. I'd be really curious to revisit that section 3 or section 15 discussion in light of the Supreme Court's sending back of the STCA challenge and some other kind of developments in the jurisprudence there. Some folks around the office have been sort of saying that maybe section 15 is the future of immigration charter litigation.
Interesting. Well, and I think did it play a role? I can't remember off the top of my head in the citizenship by dissent case.
Yes, I thought that that was the whole thing, that it was making a distinction based on national origin and
Okay,
treating.
so let's table that for a future episode to revisit. And instead, today we are talking organized crime, and I think a good place to start would be to actually start with general or serious criminality and what that entails before going into organized crime. So I don't know if you want to give like a quick two sentence or not two sentence, 2 minute rundown of how someone in Canada who has committed a crime. And we'll get into the requirement for a conviction. But yeah, how someone who has committed a crime can find themselves facing deportation.
Yeah, so there are actually three heads of inadmissibility for serious criminality, and that's the criminal inadmissibility that applies to permanent residents and foreign nationals, not just temporary residents or foreign nationals. But the first is conviction. The simplest to prove for the CBSA, if they're bringing the allegation, is you've been convicted in Canada of an offense under an Act of Parliament that is any federal legislation that has offenses embedded in it, punishable by a maximum term of imprisonment of at least 10 years, or an offense under an Act of Parliament for which a term of imprisonment for more than 6 months has been imposed. Generally, you don't get 6 month terms for offenses where the maximum sentence is not 10 years or more, but that could happen in some cases, I suppose. That one, if your client is being accused of Section 36 1A inadmissibility that I just read out, you don't have any real defenses. Like, they're not going to bring this unless they have records from a provincial, usually superior court or provincial court, saying this person's been convicted of a serious offense. There's not a lot of grounds to fight that. The other two, there's always a little bit more to fight about. 36-1B is convicted of an offense outside of Canada that, if committed in Canada, would constitute an offense similar to 36-1A. That is, the grounds that you fight that on are always on whether the offense outside of Canada really equates to an offense inside of Canada, that requirement for dual criminality. And then third is committing an act outside of Canada that, if committed here, could constitute a violation. And that there's even more. You need the double criminality, and then you also need to demonstrate that there are still reasonable grounds to believe that that act actually happened. So there's much more to litigate if that if 36-1C is brought against someone.
And as you mentioned, inside Canada does require a conviction, which would have meant that the state had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that someone had committed a crime, or the person pled guilty, like which, you know, may there's a whole, you know, you can have whole philosophical debates about whether people who may plead guilty for a variety of reasons does mean that they were convicted of beyond a reasonable doubt, but that is
I
the legal
mean,
framework.
yes, if you plead to it, they
No, but what I mean is like you may plead because you can't afford a defense. It's kind of like how I've seen in the US context, you know, we had a case where someone was told that they would be charged with a hit and run where they drove into a fence and face up to 10 years in jail, or they could plead guilty to reckless driving and have a $200 fine. And they wanted to contest both, but you know, there's a $200 fine versus what would be thousands in legal fees. Anyway, we're kind of getting into a whole philosophical, but anyway, the idea is there is a conviction inside Canada. And so if someone has been convicted and they are going down the deportation path, what appeal rights do they have? And what is the significance of appeal rights?
Well, the immigration division where the first instance is litigated doesn't have access to humanitarian relief, basically, is the biggest difference between the immigration division and the immigration appeal division. The immigration appeal division, for cases of criminality, can offer essentially equitable relief where they say, oh, well, you've been here a long time, you've got kids here, there's the best interests of children that are going to be affected. There's considerable hardship in your home country, something that's not quite a refugee claim, but you'd have a hard time reestablishing yourself back home. We'll cut you a break. We'll give you a 5-year stay, whatever that might be. As long as you don't
And when you say a
serve,
stay, what do you mean?
sorry, your removal could be stayed. That is, they won't take your permanent residence away, or they will take your permanent residence away, but they'll stay the removal and they'll give it back to you on the other side of a certain period of time. If you don't incur any other criminal charges, you maintain the other
Yeah.
conditions of your stay. Sometimes they say you have to seek mental health treatment or substance use treatment. They can kind of impose whatever terms they want, but that's available so long as you didn't serve, is it 6 years? Yeah, 6 years or more. Sorry,
Months.
6 months or more. You maintain those appeal rights. There's obviously the 1 day difference between the 6 months in 36(1A) and the 6 months on the immigration appeal right section. Weird discrepancy in the drafting of the IRPA, but that's not the only one.
And so, yeah, I think that provides a pretty good overview of how you can face deportation for, oh, and if you are deported, what do you need to come back?
To be able to
Well,
come
actually, and there's two
back.
others. In addition to that, the other one is what are the consequences for your immediate family members if you are deported for criminality? So how do you come back and consequences for family members?
If you're coming back for criminality, you can come back with an authorization to return to Canada during your 1 year exclusion or after a one, you generally get a 1 year exclusion order and then you have to come back. You do have to overcome the criminal inadmissibility through humanitarian and compassionate relief.
Yeah.
So you require agency relief to some degree or another and potentially authorization from the minister.
Yeah. I think it's for criminality deport.
Oh, is it automatic deport? I thought that it's an exclusion. Never mind. You're probably
No,
right.
it's
I haven't looked at those
but
in a
there
while.
still is the authorization to return to Canada. So let's and then for family members, they're not automatically inadmissible, like in the temporary residence context.
Yeah, exactly.
So now we switch to organized crime. And I think when people hear organized crime, they think gangs, mafia, I mean organized crime, but that's the like, that's the literal definition of the term. But what is the threshold or the test for whether someone is inadmissible to Canada for organized crime?
So I would actually, I see what you're getting at by raising the specter that there's this kind of higher level things that people colloquially think of as organized criminal groups versus the text of the organized criminality provision under IRPA and in the criminal code. But I think actually, if you read the jurisprudence on how these things are supposed to be interpreted, they're not as different as you think. But I'll answer your question and then we can get into that. So, for immigration purposes, the provision is either being a member of an organization that is believed on reasonable grounds to be or to have engaged in activity that is part of a pattern of criminal activity planned and organized by a number of persons acting in concert in furtherance of the commission of an offense punishable under an act of parliament, blah, 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 blah. So you're basically talking about people acting in concert to commit offenses over some period of time. There's the planned and organized section if you're reading this completely on its own, absent the
Yeah.
jurisprudence that interprets it, you can kind of say it's a group of some number of people coming together to commit criminal offenses. And then there's a subsection B that is about transnational, or sorry, engaging in the context of transnational crime activities such as people smuggling, trafficking persons, money laundering, and other proceeds of crime. So there's this secondary thing that is more of a commission-based offense. But I think you wanted to talk more about 37(1)(a), which is this organized criminal group or being a member of a group that conducts criminal activity in a planned and organized fashion.
Yeah.
Now, the Federal Court of Appeal actually has said that basically what we've suspected or what we've argued for some time, that a Supreme Court decision in 2010, B10, about it was a Sun-C case, made it clear that the 37 provisions, both of them, need to be read harmoniously with the criminal code definition of organized criminal group. And that's a little more explicit at section 46(7)(1) sub 1. A criminal organization means a group, however organized, that is comprised of three or more persons in or outside of Canada and has as one of its main purposes or main activities the facilitation or commission of one or more serious offenses that, if committed, would likely result in the direct or indirect receipt of a material benefit, including a financial benefit, by the group or by any of the persons who constitute the group. So that's a lot more specific. And on top of that, the Supreme Court has considerable jurisprudence, and the criminal and the provincial superior courts and appellate courts have considerable jurisprudence interpreting this provision. Particularly, the 2012 Supreme Court decision in Vinery sets out that however organized doesn't mean no organization. It means
Yeah.
it implies some level of structure and continuity that is important for elevating this above other a group criminal offenses. That is other, there's other party liability under the criminal code that is captured and captures just sort of groups of people doing crime. And that's where I think the immigration system has not actually caught up, particularly in the charging. The immigration division, I think, is catching on to the way that you do need these elevated thresholds to establish an organized criminal group. But CBSA still, I think, charges people with Section 37 inadmissibility for things that look far more like common intention offenses. And I think different members of the immigration division interpret things differently. Some treat this crim org definition like a checklist. Well, there's three or more people, there was a crime committed, at least one, and there was a material benefit. Check, check, check. Inadmissible. And they don't actually think about the parliamentary intent behind this provision and what the Supreme Court has said in interpreting the provision about who it's actually meant to capture. And Vinery, and most recently highlighted by the Supreme Court in a 2023 case, Abdullahi, about jury instructions, says really specifically that the point of this structure and continuity, this however organized, is to draw a distinction between these common intention offenses and those groups that pose an elevated threat to society. And that elevated threat to society is exactly what you introed this section with, that you were talking about gangs. We're talking about organizations that are so organized, so able to, obfuscate their activities and hide from police and defy police that they pose some threat to the orderly functioning of society that deserves sanction beyond what you would normally get for the commission of criminal offenses. And that's really what the immigration provision, if we're to understand the B10 decision, that's what the immigration system's meant to address too. And I don't think it's always being applied that way, particularly again at the charging stage.
So I'll give you two scenarios, one that you see in the court or the division cases, one that I've discussed with friends. So the one that you see in the division sometimes is Three or more people who, say they're going into a convenience store and one person talks with the cashier, the other two people are in the store stealing bags of chips, other convenience store items. And I've seen that similar type cases in the division where the cases seem to go both ways. Do you, Connie Campbell trite law, believe that that is, that that should meet the threshold for organized crime?
So going through the definition, you can say yes, there's three or more people in Canada. Yes, the main purpose that they've come together for in this instance is to, knock over this convenience store. And there's a material benefit in the acquiring of these delicious comestibles. So you've got the basic tick box. And there's a, I should say actually, because shoplifting, theft under, is a max term of imprisonment more than 5 years or 5 years or more? I don't think
Yeah,
so.
I'm not
So it
sure.
wouldn't hit the criminal code definition because the theft isn't big enough. But we could double check. Theft under might be more serious than I thought. I don't do a lot of theft under cases.
Yeah. Oh, but if we
But
elevate it to, I don't know. Let's say that there is a fraudulent ID involved or a credit
yeah,
card
something.
involved
There's
and something
some
involving fraud, which does meet the
routinely charged.
threshold,
Yeah.
which actually will then get into my second scenario, which is let's say you have a fraternity where a bunch of their members are 18 and the fraternity is helping provide fake IDs. This was more common when I was an undergrad. I don't know if it's as easy now with all the security features that IDs have, but let's say that that there's people at the fraternity who are helping with the provision of fake IDs so that people can go drinking. Would that meet the threshold of organized crime? I've never seen a case about this, but it's an example that, like, when I chat with friends from undergrad about all this, the stuff that may or may not have occurred, but, the consequences, if someone was an immigrant.
Well, it's not that far off from things that have been charged. I believe there were 37 allegations brought against Sunny Wang and others in that context, in the context of a large immigration fraud, and part of it was falsifying documents. So that certainly has been charged.
Yeah, Sunny Wang
And
did have organized crime elements brought. I do know that.
so that one, I think, is clearly yes, and it's more of a matter of should it be brought for policy reasons? That is this conduct serious enough, even though it meets the definition? And this is basically my problem with the way that seriousness is established. Like, sentencing ranges are used throughout the criminal code to distinguish serious from non-serious, but there's also an understanding that whether charge approval is done in the province of in question in Ontario, say it's police that get to do charge approval, in BC it's the Crown. But there's some duty on the Crown to only bring cases that are in the public interest. And CBSA has a similar duty, but they lean back on their overriding duty to perpetuate this immigration enforcement machine much more aggressively than prosecutors do. And I think there's much less of a culture of kind of public-mindedness amongst the Border Services Agency. And I don't necessarily fault them, like they're working under their marching orders, but I don't think that they have the sense that their job is to bring charges that are in or allegations of inadmissibility in the public interest. They seem to bring allegations that they think they can win. Their kind of guiding principle is, can we win at the division, or can we advance the law in our favor with this case, as I think they did in Mason? Like, can we come up with a
Yeah.
creative argument to push a novel version of this provision? And sometimes, as you see in like the Lee decision that you and Will Tao discussed some weeks ago, the court buys into this. This wasn't a CBSA decision, that's a visa office decision, but it's a similar thing where you have the federal court signing off on this very creative or expansive interpretation. And the question of whether something meets the definition or meets the text of the law and even the intent of the law, that is, you can fit it into these very broadly interpreted terms. And Veneri does still say that the definition of criminal organization does need to be interpreted broadly to encompass groups that aren't handing out membership cards. Not everybody is the Hells Angels who have a very strict kind of entry policy into their arguably criminal organization. But most other groups don't do that. These are informal organizations, just like terrorist organizations, which similarly the courts have said need a broad interpretation to capture this. But that broad interpretation is still meant to capture something nefarious. It's meant to capture something, again, that poses an elevated threat to society. And that part isn't cluing in. And the elevated threat is what's coming out of the need for structure and continuity. It's not an additional threshold, but it does suggest that that is what is meant to be targeted by these provisions. And I don't think that it's been internalized in the culture at CBSA to only bring these charges or only bring these allegations against individuals who are have participated or who they think have participated in that kind of a group.
It's a
They
very
often.
interesting point about the maximum sentence because, you know, right now, like the liberals have introduced a bill that has made hate speech punishable by max life in prison. And there are some commentators who are appalled by this, saying, oh my gosh, you're going to go to jail for life for speech. And others who are responding saying, yeah, no, but that's just the max sentence. No Canadian is ever going to go to jail for life. And as they are making that argument, I've been thinking to myself, kind of what you just said. Yeah, but I could see CBSA coming up with a creative argument to ban someone from Canada for life for organized crime in that context. Say, if they're posting in a WhatsApp group where they're posting, you know, just hateful memes or something. And kind of where that max in the immigration world, those maximum sentences do have big consequences.
Yeah, my point on the max sentence is really just to draw it out a bit, is to say that the sentencing range is meant to encompass crimes of various levels of seriousness, and treating everything that's charged as a certain kind of offense as the most serious version of that offense for immigration and admissibility, particularly where there's no appeal rights, gets really dicey because you're not assigning proportion, like consequences that are proportional to the conduct. You're just saying, does this meet the formal definition of an indictable offense or of an offense that has a potential max of 10 years? And I think that structurally, that's what the IAD is meant to do with their humanitarian relief. You're supposed to be able to say, well, actually, I did get convicted of this crime, but I was only sentenced to a very small amount of time. Please give me another chance. And usually they do in cases where, you think that they should, or where even counsel who are maybe less bleeding heart than I am are kind of like, ah, whatever. Usually the IAD gives people relief. I have multiple clients who have a string of criminal offenses, usually related to a serious addiction or mental health or some combination of the two. And those people are often given several chances before they really impose removal or impose serious immigration sanction. There's none of that relief for organized criminality. And again, as with Mason, CBSA is bringing these allegations against people where there is no conviction,
Okay, so let's pause on that.
specifically
So, I mean, you
that.
just hit the first. So, let's get into the distinction where people will say, well, what is it? What is so bad about organized crime? And you kind of just answered it, but let's start with question one or number one. Do you need to be convicted?
Clearly, no. The criminal code says there needs to be the commission or facilitation of criminal offenses. So there needs to be some crime at the core, but you don't necessarily need to have proven that there was a conviction, and the
And
federal
so,
courts have been
what
clear
does
on that.
CBSA need to prove?
I think that that's actually still a little ambiguous for the element of the commission of serious criminal offenses, but they effectively just need to show that a crime happened
On like a
that
balance
was
of probabilities,
on a
reasonable to,
reasonable on reasonable grounds
yeah.
to believe, to show that there that a crime happened and that this group did it or facilitated it.
Yeah, so no conviction required. You can even have an acquittal because the standard is different, O.J. Simpson kind of style. And you mentioned no appeal rights, so no humanitarian and compassionate
The
consideration.
minister has appeal rights, though. If you win at the immigration division, the minister can turn around and say, actually, we want another shot at it. And they can file new evidence against you. If the ID says, well, there's not enough evidence of XYZ, they can just pad their case
Yeah.
on appeal.
And no humanitarian and compassionate considerations ever. And if someone is deported over this to lifetime ban, how do they have to come back?
You, as you well know, you can only come back with specific ministerial relief. That is the minute, then it's non-delegatable. So they have to, it has to be signed by the minister on their desk. And I can't imagine what the stack of ministerial relief applications is like.
Yeah, I mean, I've tweeted the stats. There's hundreds of them, and the big thing that, like, re I mean, they take 10 to 15 years to protest process. So going back to that frat house, you know, if they're an undergrad, they're looking at 30 to 35 before they can come back. And there again is during that process, no consideration of their humanitarian or compassionate circumstances.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
There's some argument that the Section 40, if they're a permanent resident, that the 44-1 screening charges or screening process could provide some humanitarian relief.
Do you want to touch on that? That's before the Supreme Court.
Well, leave pending before the Supreme Court. We'll see what
Yeah.
happens. I'm not on this case. I've said to you, I'm not as well read up, but there is some argument to say that there's some recent development at the Federal Court of Appeal saying that there's at least some disclosure obligations at the charge screening phase, or what the immigration equivalent of a charge screening phase, where they're sort of seeking input on the potential humanitarian aspects of a case. It's unclear what CBSA's full discretion is to decline to pursue inadmissibility against people. Basically, the only rule at this point is if they offer it, they do have to reasonably consider the humanitarian implications, but it's something less than a fulsome H&C consideration.
Yeah. And we
So
talked
it's
about this with Michael Green, who's the lawyer for Jasker and Sidhu about how limited their discretion is. One thing I don't get is why CBSA still asks for all these submissions regarding agency if they're not.
And then does nothing with
if
them.
If they're yeah. not, yeah, does nothing with them and not allowed to consider them. I'm not sure what's going on behind the scenes there.
I think that there's a policy that for PRs, they do this. And there is limited, but still some discretion not to pursue. I think that what should probably happen, and this goes back to my earlier point about some kind of public interest in the allegations themselves, is there should be more of both a humanitarian and a public interest screen internally at the minister saying, is this something that we want to actually pursue? Do we think this conduct is bad enough to warrant dragging them through this process? Not just on their individual level, or that is, do they have enough of an attachment to Canada to deserve to still be here despite the conduct? But is this conduct we need to be trying to penalize at this elevated level, the most elevated level? Organized crime, human rights abuses, and security inadmissibility are the three that entail these very, very harsh consequences, including for refugees, claimants, risk of refoulement back to persecution. These are incredibly serious, and then the Supreme Court has made clear that they understand how serious these allegations are. Surely there needs to be some weighing of both the humanitarian and the public interest in bringing these allegations. And it's unclear the extent that an individual could challenge the decision to proceed or not on the humanitarian considerations. I think that there needs to be some space for that. But the courts have really, really narrowed it in past years of whether you can even seek relief.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of this stems from 2013 with the Faster Removal of Foreign Criminals Act, which in this context, I mean, in all contexts, got rid of humanitarian and compassionate considerations for organized crime and all the security provisions. And I happen to be a believer that officers should always be able to consider all the circumstances of someone while making a decision. That's just where a philosophical, position that I have.
Yeah, and that's the problem, is that there were these relief valves built into the act, and the provisions are written and the jurisprudence, much of it built up at a time when there was more relief. So you have these very broad provisions, and then the courts come in and say, well, there's still ministerial relief, so the earlier comments about humanitarian relief still apply because there's still some way to overcome this inadmissibility. So we can still maintain these very, very broad understandings of what conduct and what factual circumstances justify this level of inadmissibility. But I just don't think that the Faster Removal of Foreign Criminals Act adequately addressed these concerns. They basically pushed all the humanitarian consideration into Section 44 to referrals to inadmissibility, where it's not built in and the statute doesn't allow it and policy doesn't allow it. So it's just the only place left where there could be humanitarian relief. And I think trying to say that that's where it all needs to happen, there are some policy reasons, this sort of kind of public interest prosecution type reasons, but it's not really where the fulsome assessment of the person's circumstances should be taking place, because at that stage the conduct isn't proven. Mm-hmm. So you're in a very strange position where you're arguing, well, what you're alleging that I maybe did wasn't that bad, and also here are all the reasons that I'm really attached to Canada. It puts people in a very difficult place, because you have to make statements about your life in Canada and your contribution to Canadian society while the government is still trying to say that you did certain things that are punishable at this very, very extreme level. It's not you want that relief on the other side of the factual determinations, basically.
Yeah.
So you can, especially in a proceeding where you're a compellable witness. So, you can make statements like, oh, I'm an upstanding business member. And then they'll say, oh, well, the CBSA says you're a gangster and that these businesses are a front for money laundering. that really changes the humanitarian the level of
No,
establishment if you're so
I mean,
you
it's
it's
hard
a
to see
very
it
strange
changing because
position.
it would require an act of parliament and
Or
giving humanitarian and
constitutional challenge
or
to
a constitutional challenge,
the agency
correct.
bar.
Yeah. One of those two. And I it's hard to see the former giving humanitarian and compassionate to quote terrorists or organized criminals being a political winner.
I mean, the Trudeau
But
government has had a decade now, effectively, to reverse the Faster Removal of Foreign Criminals Act, and they
the
have
Trudeau
not.
government has had a decade to do an immigration bill,
To do
and they have
literally
not.
anything. No,
Yeah,
they've just
like.
decided to leave all of these provisions that some members of their administration even called unconstitutional or inappropriate at the time and voted against. And they've decided to just leave them on the books and let the courts sort them out and let basically the private bar and other, groups of lawyers come together and challenge the worst of them and keep everything else so that they don't wear the political consequences of knocking them down. But you end up with this very strange patchwork in both the in any number of the changes of that era of a lot of immigration legislation that was never kind of a fulsome rejigging of the system. It
Yeah.
wasn't a new IRPA, but it just really went into the guts of it, messed with a bunch of things, and never made the compensatory changes that would need to be there to keep the system kind of rational start to finish.
Yeah. You also wind up with this system where the laws and the rhetoric often seem out of sync, because I can't think of examples off the top of my head, but where I've grumbled when I've heard politicians speaking about the state of a law, thinking if only there was like, if only the prime minister was able to pass a law to change what he is criticizing.
Yeah, there is the sort of our hands are tied by the laws that we as Parliament can change, or we
Yeah.
as or regulations that we as the GIC could amend. There's no, yeah, there I do feel like there's a real cop out to how
Yeah.
this government and other governments have dealt with immigration law and legislation generally. It's kind of a shame.
I want to switch gears in the time that we have left to responding to a listener question. The listener question itself was very narrow, and I'm going to broaden it. The listener question was essentially or explicitly, how can the legal profession screen for Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism? And I want to broaden that question, although if you have thoughts on the specific, we can talk about that as well, to instead of how the legal profession can screen for, because presumably that can be screened through like a checklist, the same way that you can do a citizenship values test, or some sort of background checks. Should the legal profession be screening for things like Islamophobia, anti-Palestinian racism, or any other values? How's that for broad?
Yeah, I think that it's a really difficult question because there is some like with hate speech laws, like should and does the legal profession screen out avowed Nazis? I don't actually know the state of the I don't know the handbook well enough, the Law Society Code of Conduct, but there is some level of conduct that can lead to a bad character assessment
Yeah.
and
And I
can
think
lead
it's
you to be
similar to other professions like the psychologist profession or whatever they're called. I know with Jordan Peterson, he was sanctioned for stuff that could bring the legal profession into disrepute.
And I agree with that on a basic level, but I have a allergy. I think as somebody who holds probably views on most things, including the rights of Palestinians, far to the left of the norm, and certainly far to the left of the median Canadian lawyer, I worry that on some level the regulation of thought and conduct ends up becoming a power play. And I don't think that this listener or I have enough numbers to win that fight. As much as people complain about the woke mob, there's not that many people who actually hold fairly committed anti-oppressive or anti-imperialist or whatever you want to say views. And I think that as soon if you could get a majority of benchers of a given law society, so there's the question of should, and I'll address that later, but could they? And I think that the could is interesting, not in terms of like how do you screen for it, because I think that's actually pretty hard, but could you in terms of could you get the regulations passed at the provincial law societies? And I think no, I think we would lose that fight. And what I would be really worried about, and what I worry about particularly in the area of transgender rights, indigenous rights, and on, is that these things are really quite tenuous. And what you and you want to be really careful when you're advocating for the suppression of particularly noxious ideas is that a lot of people think that the ideas that I hold on things like the ability of children to access gender-affirming care are seen as noxious. And there is a contingent of people who would probably like to see me barred from the legal profession, or my partner, or other people in the teaching profession, especially from being allowed to hold those views and be a member of that profession. So I am really, really allergic to screening ideology at the gate of any profession, really, and the law in particular, because so much of my work and many lawyers is opposing
The
state
majority, or the
control
majority at the time.
and representing really unpopular people, people who've done really heinous things sometimes, and making sure that they get a fair trial or a fair administrative process or whatever it is, and being able to do unpopular things and speak quite openly on behalf of your client in court or on behalf of yourself in different fora is really important to be able to continue doing that work at a high level and to be continue to do that work effectively. And as soon as you start talking about our kind of non-governmental regulators screening ideologically, you're inviting more political interference at the provincial level into the internal function of the law society, which I think I'd be really worried about, and you risk really further politicizing the profession. So as much as I'm genuinely concerned at, full disclosure, I've been involved in a collective of lawyers who have advocated for the family reunification temporary visa program for Canadians with extended family members in Gaza. Like, there are lawyers who are out there putting out press releases and talking to media saying that this is a corridor for terrorists to enter Canada. And I think that's abhorrent. And I think that it's equating the place of your birth and the place, actually, in many cases, people who were pushed out of pre-1948 Palestine or mandatory Palestine into Gaza, within their own lifetimes. You're saying they're de facto a security risk to Canada because of the fact of where they're living or the place of their birth or their religion or their national affiliation. Like, that's, I think that the speech is abhorrent, but I don't think that those people should lose their licenses to practice law. It's just not the terms that this debate needs to be had on.
And I mean, that kind of comes like it's the, Deanna and I, when we talked about screening immigrants for anti-Semitism, came, you haven't explicitly touched on this, although you've maybe put it even more eloquently or just in a different lens, which is like group that do you, the, you, you know, people kind of raise these screening tests, assuming that what they want screened for is what the people in power would want screened for. And it's like that hypothetical when people were calling for the Emergencies Act to be enacted in Ottawa, and some people who were expressing caution were saying, okay, but like we're giving this power now. Do we want to give this power to Pierre Poilievre when he's, if and when he's prime minister, for things like would he use it for IDLE no more? and similar to that. So, on the specific issue, because one thing I have been asked by,
Before you jump into, I do think like on the anti-Semitism question, like look at Germany's anti-Semitism laws. Like most of the people being targeted by the German government at this point are anti-Zionist Jews being targeted and having their speech seriously curtailed because they're speaking out against what's being done in their name. Like it becomes absurd at a
So
point.
what are they? I'm not familiar with German anti-Semitism law. I mean, in Canada, the promotion of anti-Semitism is a criminal offense. And I mean, there's other ways to address specific concerns about what was it, anti-Palestinian or Islamophobic sent not sentiments, but actions or statements may fall under. You know, if someone's not hiring a lawyer because they are Muslim or something like that, but I mean, it's not hiring a lawyer. If a lawyer is not hiring another lawyer because they are Muslim or something like that, there are existing measures in the law. Does Germany have something beyond what we have in the criminal code in Canada?
Yeah, their definition and their interpretation of anti-Semitism is quite a bit broader and arguably brushes up against any criticism of the state of Israel.
Okay.
But not to get too deep into this, but read the Masha Gessen has a really good piece in the New Yorker about their
You'll have
own
to
experience of
text or email
this.
me how to spell that
Sounds
because
good.
I'm not going to be able to paste that,
Look it
flip
up.
that up
On the
based on
question
the
of like
name.
how do you address this stuff, like there were really concerning, like the debate in the legal community, without getting myself in too much like hot water here, is really gnarly. There were lawyers calling for the students at Metropolitan University in Toronto who signed a particular letter that spoke out in favor of Palestinian resistance that was read as an endorsement of the October 7th attacks, saying that those students should be blacklisted from being hired, and that organizing on the part of lawyers in Toronto or these calls for that kind of blacklist is seriously concerning. But the idea that that the answer to that is to kick those people out of the profession, to me, is not a useful way of dealing with the problem, and only serves to really turn up the pressure on something that's already boiling over.
Yeah, and I definitely think that temperatures need to be turned down. And I understand that some people would respond and say, well, how can you turn down the temperatures when there's a genocide? But I do think that temperatures in Canada do need to be turned down over it. One kind of subset that some people commented on was, and it's a general question that maybe you've been asked as well, which is, oh, you're an immigration lawyer. Do you believe that everyone should be allowed into Canada and that no one is illegal? And you
Yes.
kind of saw a variation of that pop up. Well, so I mean, you may believe that, but do you think that someone is a bad immigration lawyer if they do believe that, let's ignore, you know, what you said about how lumping all Gazans in as a potential terror threat and the reasonableness of that. But the idea that immigration lawyers could have concerns about security or support deportation or things like that. You know what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, of course.
Does
I mean,
that make
there's
them
a
a bad
distinguishing between
lawyer?
like being a good lawyer is representing your client effectively. Being a good lawyer has nothing to do, I think, with your political beliefs necessarily,
Yeah.
other than if you're allowing your political beliefs to compromise your effective advocacy. And in those cases, like there are probably clients that I might not take for political reasons. There are a lot of, there are people being deported, or there can, some historic security certificate cases about former Nazis being deported from Canada. I don't know that I would necessarily take that client. It depends on the circumstances, I suppose.
Yeah.
I've definitely talked this through about representing accused members of the IRGC or other organizations that are said to be persecuting queer people really aggressively. But I,
At what was
some
the
of my
acronym?
hero, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard
Oh,
Corps,
the IRG. Yeah, okay.
I But at the same time, a lot of my kind of legal heroes are people who represent war criminals at international tribunals, who have made a career of representing some of the most seemingly stigmatized people I work with. You texted me the other day asking, do you do work on behalf of accused child sexual or people accused of child exploitation offenses? And I said 100% that several of my clients have been convicted under different provisions. I that doesn't mean that I agree with their conduct. And the idea that you sort of paint lawyers with the conduct of their clients is crazy. And kind of opposed to the foundation of our legal system. And I think lawyers' personal political beliefs are similar. Like, it's not for us to decide policy. Like, there is kind of movement lawyering that is supposed to be aligned with a certain political goal. There are ways you can practice law in furtherance of political objectives. And on some level, all law is the application of power, and all politics is about the control of that power. So you can say that there's no like apolitical lawyering, and I think I mostly agree with that. But in the micro, in terms of like one individual's beliefs about whether or not states should have control of their borders, like, do I think that under ideal global circumstances, there could be free and fair movement of people to the same or even greater degree than there is the free flow of capital? Like, absolutely. Do I think that Canada unilaterally opening its borders is a good idea for the people currently living in Canada? No. Do I think that Canada's kind of an illegitimate state because we were founded on a moral proclamation that didn't adequately address prior occupation? Yeah. Is Canada an illegal occupation built on genocide? Probably. But it's here, and we've agreed to participate in this legal system. And once you've like the only thing that I think we should be screening lawyers for fundamentally is, do you believe in the rule of law? Like, do you think that it is good that we are a constitutional democracy? And do you think that everyone here should be afforded those rights under the Constitution? Yes, we can litigate exactly what the bounds of those rights are, but fundamentally, it's equality before the law, and state sanction where it touches up against life, liberty, and security in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. There's a lot of other things, but I think Section 7 and Section 15 are fundamentally the core of civic participatory rights. And that to me is the ideological screen. Like, I don't think you can be an open fascist and practice law. If you're advocating for people to lose all democratic rights, I think the same way as if you're a genuinely committed anarchist or more totalitarian communist, I think that there are ways where those kinds of political beliefs could interfere with your effective practice of law, in that you are not feeling yourself bound by the ethical obligations placed on lawyers because you don't believe in
Yeah, the ethical
the system.
obligations for sure.
So that's where things get tricky. And I think you can be an anarchist and be a good lawyer. I'm practically an anarchist, and I think I'm a pretty good lawyer.
I'm
But
all over the map. Depends on the time of day. Who's just cut me off in traffic? It's all over.
but I think you have to at least give the system some level of legitimacy. Even if you think that the foundations of it are questionable, and you're trying to push it to have a more stark dialogue with the shakiness of the foundation of the Canadian legal system, all of that I think is kind of fair play. But in terms of your engagement with the system, you need to internalize and live out the ideals of ethical lawyering. You know, that I think is what the state should be allowed to regulate.
Yeah. And I think I
Or
would
the
make
not
the
even the
same
state, but the
distinction as
law
you between
society.
like ethical lawyering and someone's personal ethics. Because I think that there's such a wide range in what people may consider to be personally ethical. But ethical lawyering, as long as someone is willing and able to basically comply with the law societies, then there's very little that I can think of off the top of my head that I would screen for, especially because I do believe, as you were saying, that as a lawyer, if you choose to take, like, and I don't think there's anything wrong with taking on cases that you're not comfortable with.
Other than if you can't like fairly represent that person. Like, I know some people starting criminal defense law that are really queasy about sexual assault. And there are some lawyers who
I
say
don't think
that
they
makes
should
them
be.
a bad lawyer, and others who I think take the position that you, if you don't feel you can advocate on behalf of someone to the best of your abilities and make full answer in defense and do zealous advocacy, that you shouldn't take that case.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, what would make them a bad lawyer, in my opinion, is if they took it on and then threw it in, like threw in the towel on it for their if their personal ethics were that they thought, I don't know, all pedophiles should go to jail. And so in their representation, that personal ethic seeped through and they just threw the guy's case away, or woman's case away, or whatever, however it may be, then yeah, that would be, I don't know how you screen for it. But that would be where I would think personal ethics. Same thing, like if somebody believed that, you know, if someone were to believe that all Gazans posed a security threat, I may disagree. And I've stated on the podcast that I disagree. But fine, like I don't think that makes them a bad lawyer unless they then represent them and, like, you know, misrep the hell out of their application in order to ensure that they're refused and write, I'm a terrorist on it. Yeah, I'd be.
And
that,
I do have
that
some
is where
concerns
I'd probably
with this
draw that
particular
line.
Example where there are a lot of people. There's a group of, like, Lawyers for Secure Immigration is a group that is formed around this issue, and many of their members have spoken out publicly. And I kind of, you know, commend that they've done so. I don't agree with what they're saying, but at least they're putting their name on it. But there are other people signing these open letters or putting their support behind these open letters without putting their name out there. So you have people who may not know that their lawyer is also taking these very strong political stances. And I think that's where it gets a bit questionable. Anyway.
Yeah, I haven't thought
on
fully
the,
thought
but
through
I do think there's a bit of a
signing anonymously.
To just say that it's up to the Law Society. You know, you just have to follow what the Law Society says. Like, the Law Society is also a contested site. Right? Like, people stand for election on certain platforms.
Yeah, that's
and
fair.
One of those platforms might be, I want to impose stricter ideological screenings, stricter anti-racism principles. And obviously that became a big fight
in Ontario.
In Ontario,
yeah.
the statement of principles to practice basically like anti-oppressive, kind of fairly watered down EDI language. But I think that the strong version of that is that lawyers have a duty to not further the disadvantage of disadvantaged groups. And I kind of agree with that. And so to the extent that the letter writer is coming in saying, like, should we screen for Islamophobia? I think it'd be impossible to do so. I think you'd probably lose a lot of really good lawyers if you actually had a way to look into everybody's brain and say who holds personal prejudice. Like, I think many people of all generations hold all sorts of prejudice and are hopefully working to address it. And there are some who are kind of more actively living that out or taking public stances that some could conceive as Islamophobic or engaging in anti-Palestinian racism or whatever the issue might be. But I don't know that it's useful or a useful political project to try to exclude those people from the profession rather than just engaging in more regular speech, debate, politics. Like, they're sort of the, like, capital P politics of taking over the Law Society, changing the rules, imposing these strict things. And then there's the politicking of what kind of speech do we as a legal community want to.
Yeah, no, and as we've learned from the internet, more speech leads to the truth.
Absolutely.
Not that
marketplace of ideas, it always wins out.
It always wins out. There's no misinformation on the internet. The lizard people are coming. We have learned it. And on that kind of silly note, to end a serious podcast, with a definite serious topic at the end. Thank you for coming on.
I appreciate the time, and I hope that I get lots of nice listener feedback from both the question writer and anyone else who wants to take issue with my various bullheaded political stances.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.